I took an English class in high school, and it was on poetry. And it's supposed to be kind of like an overview, a survey kind of class where they just talk about poetry. And I always remember the very first day, teacher, you don't remember the teacher's name except that it was Jeff. Anybody have a high school teacher insist you call him by his first name? He was one of those dudes. Yeah. I had two. He was one of them. But Jeff read us Trees by Joyce Kilmer. And I always thought that that was funny because I didn't know that it was an actual poem. I thought it was from a cartoon because that was where I heard it before. But y'all know this poem. I think that I shall never see a poem lovely as a tree. A tree whose hungry mouth is pressed against the earth's sweet flowing breast. A tree that looks at God all day and lifts her leafy arms to pray. A tree that may in summer wear a nest of robins in her hair, upon whose bosom snow has lain, who intimately lives with rain. Poems are made by fools like me, but only God could make a tree. Now, the reason that I remember that poem, because he couldn't say it to a bunch of dumb sophomores in high school back at the time, but he wanted to get across of how ironic a poet Joyce Kilmer was. Because what he did was that he took the words from the poem and he drew a picture of what she was describing on the board. And it looked ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. A tree with a mouth sucking water out of the ground. He didn't draw bosoms or breasts, but you get the idea. He just turned around and looked at us and says, you get it, don't you? And arms with leaves hanging from him. It looked absolutely ridiculous. And that was the irony of the poem, is that here we were in a classroom, in a curriculum funded by taxpayer dollars to try to dissect and look at the art and artistry of poetry. And Kilmer all along is saying, you know what? My words describing a tree are ridiculous. The tree is right out there. Go take a look. And I think that sometimes that's the way that we approach the book of Revelation, is that he told us in the very first words exactly what it's about. Yet we dive into words given to a vision, put into words to give to us, and we spend all of our time dissecting the vision and the words and everything else, when actually he told us at the very beginning, this is the revelation of Jesus Christ. The irony of the book of Revelation is that we miss just that very point. And in our vision, what we've been looking at, in our vision in chapter 4 and chapter 5, is about that. We looked through the seven churches and looked at the church all through history, all the way up to us, all the way up to Laodicea today. And we're left in a pretty bleak place, that Laodicea, the church of the end time, the church that you and I belong to, is one that is in deep trouble because we've decided to lock him out. And in a way, to lock him out and focus on the what? Focus on the words. Focus on the words of the poem. Focus on the words of a vision. So I believe what happened is that John was shown a vision. That's what he says. He was shown a vision. So we're looking at the vision through the eyes and through the language of a man who lived 2,000 years ago. Now that's what we have. But I don't believe that we were meant to leave it on the page. I don't believe that we were meant to study the poem and forget the tree. So that's where we are. And we've been looking at this vision, and we looked at it overall, and we note that the very most central, important part of the vision is that that eternal worship of God was interrupted by mankind's history, and God would not resume worship until mankind was taken care of. He would not resume or allow the worship to resume of him until Jesus had come, until the Lamb that was slain had taken the throne. In order to give Laodicea hope, in order to give you and me hope, we've closed the door. We are rich and have need of nothing. We don't even know anymore that we are poor, miserable, wretched, pitiable, blind, and naked. We don't know any of those things anymore. And the door was slammed shut by us, and Jesus is gently knocking, inviting us to invite him in. Until that takes place, even the worship in heaven had ceased. But then Jesus did something for us, for all eternity, to be able for the worship to begin again. And that's why it's a brand new song from 4 to 5. We're seeing the vision in heaven. He is showing us the vision in heaven. Yet, just a quick bit aside, what has the church then done with the very words of Revelation? We've made it as ironic as the poet with the tree. We focus on the vision and the words. And I am not... The irony is not lost as I take apart or at least look into the vision, picking certain things out, because today I want to talk about the scroll. And I know what I'm doing. I'm participating in the very irony that the poet made fun of me for back when I was a sophomore in high school. But the vision is this. I saw in the right hand the one seated on the throne, a what? A scroll written on the inside and on the back, sealed with seven seals. And I saw a mighty angel proclaiming with a loud voice, who is worthy to open the scroll and break its seals? And there was how many in heaven? None in heaven. How many on the earth? None on the earth. How many who had lived and died on the earth? Nobody, absolutely nobody, from creation till now was worthy to open the scroll or to look into it. And I began to weep bitterly because no one was found worthy to open the scroll or look into it. And then he's told what? One of the elders said, don't weep. The Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has conquered so that he can open the scroll with the seven seals. What I love about this, to look at the overview and to escape the irony of dissecting the language or the vision or anything itself, and maybe even missing that this is still about the Lamb that was slain, what I love about this is that it was shown to us to be open in heaven. And so between the seven churches and the seven seals, as we go on in Revelation, this is why I spend so much time introducing ourselves to the seals. Because he put it here on purpose. Before we look at the seals, which the seals will be the history of the end times, the presence of the end times, and the future of the end times till Jesus comes. And this is what everyone has been fascinated with, is each seal and what's going on and what that signifies and how literally or not literally we take it. If we don't, this is for the believers. Chapter 4 and 5 is not for Hollywood. Nobody wants to pay money to see movies about what happens in 4 and 5. They want to skip right to the seals. I know of several movies. There was one that actually did the seven seals. I think they called it the seals. But that's not what sells books. Chapter 4 and 5 is for us. Chapter 4 and 5 is for those of us in Laodicea who maybe have given up, who are looking on this planet as being too hard to live and too hard to endure, which is why he keeps asking for what? For perseverance. Those who conquer, come, keep coming, keep persevering. The vision is for us. Because just about the time that we think that there is no hope, just about the time that we think that God may have given up, turned around, and walked away, the vision is what we're supposed to be called back to. The door is open in heaven. Even if we slammed it shut on earth, it's open in heaven. It's open for every individual to get up and accept the invitation that he would come in and that he would place on this very throne right here, where we find the first time that we find this scroll. Now, the thing about the scroll is that we don't know anything about it except that it was pretty important, right? No one can read it or understand it or can open it up and reveal anything at this moment, which makes it pretty important, because whatever it is, it shut down the very worship of heaven. Nothing's able to occur. That ongoing worship of holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty back in chapter 4 is shut down. No creature is worshiping God anymore because no one can be found worthy to even look at what is inside the scroll. So it's a problem. By the way, the thing that hits me the most of this time studying through here, the thing that will always stick with me, is that it's a problem that not even God can fix, not even the Father can solve. The Father has abdicated, if you will, his absolute sovereignty over this, and he is handing his power to do something about this to something or someone else, and it turns out to be this lamb that was slain. That's why we as Christians worship Jesus as God, as well as being our Son of Man. He represents who? He represents us. He pays our price. He intercedes. He is the God that we worship. So it's interesting. It's an interesting mystery, if you will, up until this point with this scroll. So I just want to see if we can get a little closer to resolving the mystery before we get to the point to where we're actually breaking the seals when we get to chapter 6. So I pointed out before, some translations will say book. He was holding a book in his hand. It's not a book. It's a what? It's a scroll. Now, if book works for you, that's okay. But in this particular case, the information is contained upon the scroll. And back in the first century, still predominantly the way that you stored information was on scrolls. So the content is not found in the seals. This is what's ironic about this, is that people will concentrate and look at the seals as if the seal has some sort of content. When we get and he breaks the first seal, that's what we are concerned with. We're concerned with what is bound the seals. The content, though, of the book is not in the seals. It wasn't in a first century scroll, and it isn't now. We're not to look there. We're to look where? We're to look in the scroll. But actually, we're not even in chapter 6 yet. So you can't look there. Until it begins to be broken, and unveiled and revealed, we can't even look, you know, within it, because all we see is seven seals around this scroll, and there's nothing about it there. Up until that point, we're supposed to be looking where? We're supposed to be looking at the one who's holding it. It's there. The content of the book won't be revealed until those signs are broken. So what is the sealing about? Sealing is a sign of ownership. So you have a deed, and today even deeds have a stamp on it or a seal on it. And when you see the seal, you're supposed to recognize what? You're supposed to recognize that it's valid, that it is what it claims to be. It's the seal. But at least in the Bible, not just things can be sealed. What else can be sealed? Actually, who else can be sealed? People can be sealed, right? You get to chapter 14, he says, I looked and there was the Lamb standing on Mount Zion, and with him were 144,000 who had his name on his foreheads, name written on their foreheads. God's people can be what? Sealed. In other words, you see the seal and you know who they what? You know who they belong to. This is God's people right here. In Old Testament times, the seal of the children, well, at least the seal of the sons of Abraham, were circumcision. In the first and second century, baptism was the seal. You were baptized, and that public ceremony, if you will, sealed you. In other words, I could look at this public face of something, and I could see who owns this person, who validates this person. Circumcision, baptism. The seal has to do with the ownership of God's people, with the sovereignty that God has with his sons and with his daughters. So Revelation actually is more concerned when you see seals that not that they're in a book, but that they're on a people. The seal belongs to the people. Seals might be seen as either the concealing of the contents, in other words, no one's allowed to read this, we're sealing it right here, or it is to validate its contents. Back in the day, the most common people that would have a sealed scroll or a sealed document would be kings and officials in order to be able to validate it. In other words, if a king sent you something, you need to know it came from the king. So every king had his own what? Had his own seal. In other words, no one is to open it. So it is to hide the contents until it gets to the person that it was to be for. And then the seal would tell the person, that person, that it came from this particular king or official. But the issue here is not validation. And it's not concealing or revealing. See, none of that works because that's not what's happening here. What's happening here is that it's at the right hand of the one on the throne. It's at the right hand of the one in power, and no one can what? No one can open it. So it doesn't matter if it's validated. It doesn't matter if it's concealing. It's just that we'll never know what it is because no one can open it. No one is worthy. It's written on both sides. That's appropriate language then for a scroll and not a book. It's a legal document back then. So take a look at when we first see it. It's just in the first verse of chapter 5 here. I saw in the right hand of the one seated on the throne a scroll written on the inside and on the back, sealed with seven seals. It says that it's in the right hand of the one seated on the throne. Who's seated on the throne at this point in the vision? It's the Father. He's seated on the throne. I said, do you remember that when we went through the second one, the same vision was given to Daniel in chapter 7. The judgment scene in chapter 7, the Ancient of Days is sitting on the throne. And then later in the vision, this divine Son of Man shows up and takes the throne. It's the same vision given to Daniel. By the way, what happened to the book of Daniel when he was done writing it? He was told to what? He was told to seal it. Because it isn't until Jesus does what he does that we would even be able to understand the visions of Daniel. He says, I don't want people messing with your visions until I fulfill them all, God says to Daniel. It is for the time of the what? It's for the time of the end, he says. So it says that it's at the right side of the king. It's his highest place and honor, at the right. When you hear that, do you hear all the times that the Bible refers to at the right hand, at the right hand of power? Do you remember when, well, depends on what gospel you're reading, but do you remember when John's mother asked Jesus if her sons could sit at his what? At his right hand. Because back then, right hand, that was the place of honor. That's where it was. And what's interesting is that being left-handed, okay, is as a quirky of a thing back then as it is now. I mean, it's less than what? It's less than like even a tenth of the population is left-handed. Right-handed is where it was at back then, and it was back then. So kings decided that if you wanted a place of honor beside them, you put them where? You put them at the right. Okay. So it says at the right of the highest place. David writes it this way. He says, let your hand be upon the one at your what? At your right hand. Lord, let the one be there. David, an earthly king who knows his power, or at least shows his power by putting whatever it is to his right, he asked God to do the same. The one whom you made strong for yourself, put him where? Put him at the right hand. Put him at the right as the one who is. He says it's there, if you will, at the right. So being at God's right hand means it's at the right side. To take up the book, then, is to sit on the throne. Because the book was on the throne at his right side. And when he does that, he's modeling a particular type of kingship for everybody who would know. Remember, when somebody reads this in the first century, there are people who would know exactly what this means. And as soon as he said right hand, everybody thought, that sounds like David. So the kingship is modeling a David kingship. What's happening here? And in verse 5, it says, one of the elders said to me, don't weep. See, the lion of the tribe of Judah, the root of David, has conquered. That's why he begins to refer to David, the lion of Judah, the root of David. He's saying, here's the one. It's who? It's him. Here he is. That is him. And the reason that I say that it is at the right is because the language, I'm not saying that if your Bible says this that it's wrong, okay? I'm not saying that, because every English translation has the scroll in the right hand of the one seated on the throne. But John doesn't use in, he uses on. So it's quite possible that the one seated on the throne is not holding the scroll and handing it to the Lamb. It's actually on his throne at his right side. It's sitting there. Because remember, God himself has decided that even he's not worthy to open it. So why pick it up? It's there. You remember the two types of judgment that needed to be done. God's only judgment without Jesus, God's only judgment on creation is that we what? Is that we die. On the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die. That was the Father, that was the Creator's last words on judgment to humanity. He doesn't pick up the scroll because it sits at his right hand. It sits at the right hand of his power. Why? He decided that that judgment was not going to be our final judgment. It's quite possible that nobody has picked up the scroll until the Lamb that was slain wanders in and it's handed to him, or he picks it up, if you will. This term for right hand, this is why I say this, is that this term that we've translated as being in his right hand, it's also used for the right eye, the right side, the right cheek, the right ear, or just right as concerned with right or left. See, the New Testament is always Jesus being depicted sitting at the right hand of God. Not in his right hand, but at his right hand. Right hand is depicted as power. In all the Gospels coming up to here, in Luke 22, in Matthew 26, and Mark 14, his right hand is his power, or his right side. At his trial before he was crucified, Pilate said, don't you know? Remember, he said, don't you know I've got the power to take your life away? And Jesus, why don't you just answer me? Don't you know that I can do this to you? But he was silent, and he did not answer. And the high priest asked, I'm sorry, this is not Pilate, this is the high priest. The high priest asked him, are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One? Jesus said, I am, and you will see the Son of Man seated at the what? At the right hand of power, and coming with the clouds of heaven. Right hand is power. John uses the term epi and not in. He uses the term on. Epicenter, epigraph. It's on. It means on or upon. He didn't use the Greek term meaning in. So in the right hand may not be the best translation, even though it's in every English translation that we have. At least, maybe not literally, he's holding it there. So what's the big deal? Why is it so important to talk about the scroll maybe laying on the throne next to God? It's because when Jesus comes, he's going to pick up that scroll, kind of make room for himself. And then he's going to be enthroned in his rightful place, at his power, in the heavenly sanctuary at that time. He's there. The scroll's placement then is a reiteration, if nothing else, of the Lamb and the one on the throne now being one and the same. And then he receives all the power and all the authority and all the praise. You with me? The scroll is standing in the way of that. Jesus comes and he takes the place of the scroll. He's seated at the right hand. So whatever's in it, and again, we don't know yet, we're not told, has got to be a big deal, right? Has to be a big deal. There are several. So like I said, the irony is not lost on me that I'm going to start talking about what people have believed that the scroll is or what is actually in it. Okay. Back then, there have been, like I said, this would be from history. This would be from cultural identity back in the first century. But did you know that a Roman will had 7 witnesses to seal it in order to attest to the validity of its contents? So that kind of makes sense. Maybe it's a will, if you will. There's the Old Testament law of the Goel, and that is if a person dies, does not leave an inheritance, or it was lost, then another family can step in and buy it up and restore it to the family that was lost. Jeremiah 32 says the scroll guaranteed inheritance at a future time. So if this is it, then the Lamb is taking the title deed of the world or taking up the inheritance that Adam lost. That's not too bad. I like that. Or that he bought it back at the cross. The only problem with this is that not only wills would look like this, but every legal document would look like this. So inheritance is not worked through, if you will, the rest of the book. Where else do you see scrolls? In prophecy, at least. Ezekiel 2 and 3. Remember, Ezekiel was told to take a scroll and to eat it. Describe the experience. And the experience was that it was what? It was sweet in his mouth, but what? It turned bitter in his stomach. The one that he ate, the sweet in the mouth, bitter in the stomach, that could be. Is that the scroll? Could that be it? It's possible. Revelation 10 is built completely upon this. Revelation 10 takes Ezekiel almost word for word. Revelation 5 may use Ezekiel as a background. We've seen the same stones in the throne. We've seen the fire. We've seen the lightning. We've seen all those things in Ezekiel, from Ezekiel in chapter 5. But the contents of Ezekiel's scroll is lamentations and mourning and woe for getting hauled into captivity. Is that really all that's stopping, if you will, the worship of heaven? If all that's going to be revealed, why is John weeping that no one can open it? If the scroll only contains lamentations, why do you want to open it? Anybody here want to revisit it? Is it some sort of concealed prophecy? Isaiah 29, 11 and 18, Isaiah sealed that scroll. It says he sealed it to be revealed at a later time. So in Isaiah, the sealed prophecy is Isaiah's own book. And as I said, Daniel, he told him to seal Daniel's book. Why? Because no one's going to understand it until these things in chapter 7 and chapter 8 and chapter 9 have all been revealed. No one, until that happens, no one is going to understand it. So the scroll in Revelation 5, if you were to take that, would be Revelation itself, and that's a problem. Because we're reading about a sealed prophecy in a book that's already opened and has been opened. So I don't think it's any of those. The one that is prevailing is that could it be the Lamb's Book of Life? See, the only other book in Revelation that belongs to the Lamb is his Book of Life. I like that. The problem is this, though, is that whatever is in this scroll, it affects not just believers who would be found in the Book of Life. It affects who? It affects everyone. It affects the whole universe. Could it be a scroll of coronation? There were a couple of kings that were handed, when they took the throne, they were handed a copy of Deuteronomy. Remember that? I think Joash, and I forget who the other one was. But I think in that case, it was because it had been so long, and there were so many kings who were worshiping other gods, that they lost the scroll. And some priest said, you know what, I think what we need to do is we need to get back to something. So they were handed a scroll of Deuteronomy. And the ability to open the scroll would then say they have a right to rule. The problem is, Dr. John Pauline tells us, that there's no structural parallel to Deuteronomy. So each has some confession. Each has some connection, if you will, and a confession of words. But we really, really don't know just as yet. But could we make more of a definition if we go in the book of Revelation itself and look where the scroll is talked about then? I talked about chapter 10. He said, I saw another angel, a mighty angel coming down from heaven, wrapped in a cloud with a rainbow over his head. His face was like the sun. His legs were like pillars of fire. He looks like who? He looks like the Lion of Judah, the Lamb that was slain back from chapter 1. He also looks like God sitting on his throne in the book of Ezekiel. The rainbow over the throne and all of that. And he holds, it says, he holds a what? He holds a little scroll in his hand. Setting his right foot on the land, on the sea, and his left foot on the land. So in Revelation, we see an angel holding a little scroll in his right hand. The problem with this one, though, is guess what? It's open. It's already open by this time. But in verse 7, we're told a little bit more about this vision. In the days when the seventh angel is to blow his trumpet, the mystery of God will be fulfilled as he announced to his servants, the prophets. What is the mystery of God? It's what we don't know. We don't know what's going to happen. We don't know how he is going to work this out. What is his plan to redeem a fallen universe through the actions of Jesus? The mystery was open to everybody who would be Jesus' followers, but it's closed to those who don't know him. We live in the now and the not yet. We live in a time that by faith we're already there. Ephesians says, you're not even sitting here. When did you die to Christ? You died when he died. When were you resurrected into life? You were resurrected when he was resurrected. And when he was resurrected into life, he is now seated. You could be seated with him at the right hand of the Father. That'll be a reality, a physical reality one day. Today we only grasp it by what? We only grasp it by faith. Only people who know that know or can see what the mystery is. So in a way, it's only open to those who know him. He's the only one that offers us his righteousness by faith. It's coming. One day. We'll be seated with him. But today, we're seated as if. You with me? That's why it's a mystery. Open to those who believe, closed to those who don't. So this would come at the consummation of all this vision right here. According to verse 6, he says that there will be time no more before he opened this up. No more time prophecies, no more nothing. Don't focus on time anymore. Don't focus on days and years. Don't focus on eras. There is time no more. This is the end time. There is not another prophecy in order to be fulfilled. There's not another cosmic sign that we're to be looking for before the second coming. Do you know that after we get done with the sixth seal, you're living right there? I always, when I'm studying Revelation with somebody, well, back when I used to have a paper Bible, I would show them that when at the end of the sixth seal, I'd say, there, right there, that's where we live. The next cosmic sign will be the second coming itself. So there's no more signs to look for. There's no more prophecies to fulfill. There's no more dates to be added. Don't concentrate on any of this. So this is something that only believers would understand. But to the rest, it becomes open at the end. And by the way, who's supposed to be revealing that mystery to those who it's not open to? Us. We become whatever is the content of this scroll is. All you have to do is, like I said, Google apocalypse and see how the world is so completely confused by what this is really about. And who's supposed to unveil that for them? Who's supposed to reveal that to them? It's us. So I told you last week that I'm so disturbed that the church sometimes plays into it to tell them that the apocalypse is about the end of the world and it's about destruction and it's about all of that. We're supposed to be breaking through that mystery. So it's possibly the scroll is the revelation of Jesus. Remember he said the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave to his angel, which God gave to him, to Jesus, which gave it to an angel, who gave it to who? Who gave it to John, and then John does what? He gives it to us. It's the chain of command. And it's only in Revelation 5 that we see God handing it to Jesus. So in Revelation 10, an angel is giving it to John. So 5 and 10, perhaps we see two phases of revelation. The is and the is to come. What Jesus reveals is not just the book of Revelation itself, but God's whole plan for the universe. That's what the seals are supposed to be about. The seals are supposed to be about, but that even before the first one is cracked, where he's about to reveal it to all of everyone else, you and I already know. You and I are ready. This is some pretty nasty stuff that we're going to find in the seals. Amen? Some pretty nasty stuff. And God doesn't want it unleashed on a world that has been told that it's about their destruction. To reveal revelation to them the same way it was revealed to us. It wasn't revealed by just words. It wasn't revealed by words on a page. It's him. He lives that mystery. He offers a meal with him. He offers a relationship. I have no problem with teaching people revelation. Seals, the trumpets, whatever. But we're supposed to be doing it in the incarnation with which it was done for us. The Word became flesh and walked among us. We don't teach just the words. So we're told that all will be lost if the scroll won't be opened. And how could it be opened? It required one thing. It required that one thing that made the Lamb worthy. The Lamb wasn't worthy on his own. He needed to be the Lamb who was what? The Lamb that was slain. The cross is that event. It is it. But he has to be resurrected and ascend to receive it. Without it, all is lost. So the destiny of all of us is not assured until the cross and the resurrection. Because if he had just died and not been resurrected, he never would have made it to the throne. He never would have gotten up there in order to be given what he's given. He'd still be where? He'd still be in the tomb. And Paul told the church at Corinth, if Christ is still in the tomb, we are all up a creek. I paraphrase just a little bit. It's the event that allows God to carry out his plan. Now that Jesus is enthroned, the plan can be carried out. Now that Jesus has done what he promised he would do, that he was, he is to come. Now that it's done, now the whole thing can be revealed. The gospel. That's why the gospel, that's why the good news has to go to the entire world before he'll come. Because when he comes, that's the execution of the plan. But Jesus is now in that place. So in a way, just in a way, if you will, he is the plan. In a way, he's the scroll. It's him. It can be carried out. It's hidden as life is lived out in these days. It's hidden. Not everything is completely open to us, and not everything could be until the seals get ready to be open. But those who believe get a glimpse. And what is the glimpse that we get? We know who he is. We have figured all of that out. He allowed us to see him seated on the throne. The book of Revelation, it's for us. So in a sense, the content of the scroll is the book of Revelation and more, but it's God's plan for the entire universe, for all of creation. So through the cross and the enthronement, Jesus' plan is then set into motion. The universe will be saved. The universe will be redeemed. Without that first, all that's waiting for the universe is destruction. Lamb takes the book and he's enthroned. The plan is then activated. Does he have the power to activate it? You bet he does, because he's seated where? He's at the right side. He's in the place of power. So the cross makes this the decisive event of all Earth's history. The gospel being a concealment, but also a revelation to everybody who would what? To everybody who would believe. So I want to leave us with our scripture reading because it's so important. In fact, Christ has been raised from the dead, the first fruits of those who have died. For since death came through a human, the resurrection of the dead also comes through a human. For as in all die in Adam, so will we be made alive in Christ. But each in its own order, Christ the what? The first fruits of all the deaths that were died, all the way back to Adam. Adam's not with us anymore. He's in his grave. Of all the deaths of humanity that were died, guess who's the very first fruit to be redeemed from that death? Is Christ himself. It's life himself. Each in its own order. Christ is the first fruits. Then at his coming, who gets to be the next fruits? The dead in Christ rise, and those who are living are translated and rise. Just as he is the first fruits, you and I are the next ones. So in Revelation 5, you see it, this point in destiny where all people are assured of life because of Jesus, the cross, and the resurrection. Are there a lot of things to take place before those Stephanos crowns are handed out? Remember the ones that the elders are wearing and that you and I get to wear too? But is there things that need to take place before then? Apparently. How do we know that there are things that need to take place before now in the second coming? Is we're still what? So we're still here. So we say something's got to take place. But in the meantime, the assurance is all there. Why? Because the gospel is not poetry. The gospel is not words on a page. The gospel is not something to be studied and dissected and taken apart. The gospel is not a doctrinal statement. It's him. The scroll, if it is truly the plan for God for all the universe, then the scroll's not merely a scroll with words written on it or a vision described in it. It's him. He's the plan. That's why it's a brand new song. There's never been anybody like the Lamb. The vision's about him. It reveals him. The destruction of the planet and humanity is not revealed. In other words, that what's going to happen, all of that, the destruction of everything, doesn't happen. Nothing happens. Nothing moves forward until Jesus' plan of redemption is in place and ready to be implemented. Always remember another parallel of not being worthy is that God doesn't allow the destruction to be carried out until Jesus offers something else. He didn't want death to be the end of Adam and Eve. He wanted what? He wanted something else. So not one iota of the plan, not one iota of the scroll will be read until Jesus carries out his plan. And in a way, here in Revelation 5, it brings us all together. Everybody who's ever lived and died, we're all right here. The ironic thing is that we're still telling people to take apart the poetry, to take apart the words, to look at the dissection, to look at the images. That the scroll has to say this, and this seal, this happens. When it's all about everybody in place, and the good news being that the death and the destruction that you're about to read about doesn't need to be our final end. So remember, the scroll is at the right. Because the thing about it is, if the scroll is at the right of God, it's seated on the throne next to him, then we remember Jesus' last words to Laodicea. To the one who conquers, I'll give a place with me on my throne, just as I myself conquered and sat down with my Father on the throne. So the scroll are not words written about you and me, lost or saved. The scroll is you. If he's present, he's given his presence to us, and we become present with him. That's why Laodicea is asked to go open the door so that you'll be with me. And he's with us in the past, he's with us now, and when he is to come, we can be promised we will still be with him. So to me, the vision is beyond words. And not a poet could capture it. But I'll try with mine. And that is, whatever's contained in the scroll, whatever condemnation, whatever death is in there carried out, whatever it is, it's replaced, redeemed by Jesus, and we sit there with him. And as he's present in us, then we need to be present in the world to them. And we need to go beyond just reading them words about what we think is happening in Revelation and what's going on. We need to quit playing into the fact or the idea that time is short, you better get your act together. We need to become his presence in our lives. We need to become our presence, bringing his presence to them. He doesn't offer words. He offers him. The scroll is him. The presence is him. Our God is him. To the one who conquers, I'll give a place with me on my throne. We replace the scroll. Our presence does. Yeah, see, those words don't even